The Theosophical Society has much pleasure in presenting Mr. Geoffrey Hodson in a talk entitled Chance or Law in Human Life.
Friends, drawing upon the teachings of Theosophy, I am able to answer the question of my title in the affirmative, for my own studies have brought me to the conviction that indeed perfect justice is assured to every human being, and this by the operation of an inevitable, inescapable law of cause and effect. I further have come to believe, and this can partly be tested by the study of history, that nations also, in their national life, their successes and their failures, their ups and their downs, are also, to some considerable extent, living under the operation of this evidently fundamental law of cause and effect. However, let us examine the proposition together and see how it sounds to us under analysis. We find then that the doctrine of natural causation, or K-A-R-M-A, karma as it is called in Sanskrit, that this doctrine of natural causation is intimately associated with that of the spiritual evolution of man to perfection through successive lives on earth. Under karmic law, every human action, mental, emotional, or physical, produces an exactly appropriate reaction, motive playing a decisive part in the nature of that reaction. These results are, however, not always received in the same life in which the acts were committed. In such cases, they remain in suspension, as it were, in a kind of abeyance, until in a later incarnation, conditions arise in which they can be justly and appropriately experienced. For the exactness of the operation of the law of cause and effect demands that causes must produce their effects at the level, on the plane, and in the world in which the cause was generated. Otherwise, of course, it would be most unjust. Physical actions produce physical effects, as we know very well. If we put our finger in the fire, we burn our physical fingers. But also emotional, mental, and spiritual actions produce their effects in their appropriate worlds. Since every physical action of one life cannot produce its full reaction during that lifetime, a return to earth is necessitated in order that the essential condition, awareness in a physical body, can be established. St. Paul would seem to refer to this in his words, following his enunciation of the law of sowing and reaping. He wrote, "For he that soweth to the flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption, but he that soweth to the Spirit shall of the Spirit reap life everlasting." I presume you remember the sowing and reaping analogy to which I referred. Shall I just repeat it, however? St. Paul wrote, "God is not mocked, and whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap." And then followed the verse from Galatians 6, verse 8, that I've just read to you, suggesting St. Paul's knowledge of the fact that reactions always occur at the level, in the body, on the plane, where the actions were committed. Now let us look a little more closely at the idea. According to this view, the merits and demerits of previous lives on earth determine the conditions of the present one. Each man generates the causes of which his later experiences are the effects. Conditions of human life, whether of health, happiness, capacity and opportunity, or their unfortunate opposites like disease, sorrow, weakness and limitation, these, according to this idea of causation, all of these conditions, pleasurable and painful, are the results of the operation of exact law. They are reapings from past sowings by the person who is undergoing the reaction. Combined, as many sages have said, the doctrines of reincarnation and karma thus provide a solution consistent with logic and justice of the problem of the inequalities of human birth and opportunity, the divergences and the differences in bodily and mental condition and capacity, of course, and the varied environments into which people are born and in which they live. These are not just the result of mere blind chance. They are the direct effects of preceding conduct. There is a karma. Shall I continue to use that word now? K-A-R-M-A, Sanskrit. It really means action and refers to the process of action and reaction in this sense. And so it is taught there is the karma of merit and the karma of demerit. Karma itself neither punishes nor rewards. It is simply the one universal law which guides unerringly and, so to say, blindly all other laws productive of certain effects along the grooves of their respective causations. Causes which are undying, which cannot be eliminated from the universe until replaced by their legitimate effects and wiped out by them, so to speak. And such causes or such results of actions, unless compensated during the life of the person who produced them with adequate effects, these will follow the reincarnated ego and reach it in its subsequent reincarnation until a harmony between effects and causes is fully established. The doctrines of reincarnation and karma, as you will see, do in fact, at least mentally, provide logical solutions to the problems of human living. There is not, cannot be, undeserved human suffering. Every experience, it is affirmed, is the product of some preceding action by the individual to whom the experience comes, whether that action was performed in a former or in the present life. The goal of human existence is the attainment of the stature of the perfect man, and this attainment is assured to the spiritual self of every human being, but it has been achieved under the operation of this law of cause and effect. And indeed, action and reaction, especially the latter, prove to be among the greatest of men's teachers. The interesting topic of child prodigies, for example, These are not chaotic sproutings from the tree of human life. They are demonstrations of the fact that every individual has lived before, has striven and attained in preceding incarnations. In rare instances, the fruits of that attainment, the effects of the generated causes, force their way through the childish brain and body. And when parents and teachers recognize the significance of the phenomenon, a reasonable measure of intelligent training enables the past genius to flower early in the new life. It's not my subject now, but may I say that I don't think there can be a perfect educational system without recognition of the doctrines of rebirth and cause and effect. I have also come to believe, as a student of theosophy, that without reincarnation, psychiatry, psychoanalysis, psychosomatics, and Dianetics are incomplete. They're not fully satisfactory methods of diagnosis and treatment because they depend upon this one life alone. So often the causes of the aberrations of psychology and mentality which they deal with lie in former lives. And when this is recognized, a great advance in all of these remedial sciences, as well as elsewhere, will be achieved by man. At this point, I want to put forward a very important principle concerning that operation of the law of cause and effect. It was hinted at in the passage I repeated just now, concerning compensation in the action of the law. Let me work it out a little bit more fully. I call it in my own thinking the principle of the modification of karma. This is achieved by intervening actions performed before causes have had time to produce their full effect. Both individuals and nations, by their subsequent actions, are constantly modifying the operation of the law upon themselves. Whatever one's actions in the past have been, good or bad in varying degrees, their reactions are not to be regarded as irretrievable fate or as a fixed dead weight from which there is no relief. Neither individuals nor nations are paralyzed by their past actions. Everything is not irretrievably fated, however good or bad the past. Man can master circumstances and make of each experience an opportunity for a fresh beginning, however heavily the past may weigh upon him. Let us take an example in illustration of this principle of compensation, or as I call it, the modification of karma. Supposing one has been, for example, the governor, viceroy, or consul with considerable power over a colony, and while starting well with perhaps the ideal of the people well to the forefront of one's thoughts, one finds that personal power and even wealth can be extracted from the people. Then, as the idealism becomes bedulled, methods of the extraction of wealth, the oppression of the people, gradually begin to be applied until real and definite cruelty becomes characteristic of the local administration. Now, in consequence of every cruel act and of all the illegal and harmful proceedings, there will have to be reactions, and these will be received by the actor, in this case, the viceroy, for example. Supposing, however, that they die before the trouble comes to them, it will then be held in suspension until a later incarnation and a suitable condition. If, however, and this is the important point, in the meantime that person has a change of heart and becomes a lover of their fellow men, a healer, a teacher of their fellow man, and lives a life in one of the remedial or educational professions, generating great benefit, then every such beneficial act will tend to reduce the amount of adversity accruing from the previous cruel and oppressive action. Every succeeding action either increases or decreases the results of former conduct. If a person who has been cruel becomes later fulfilled with love and lives a life of loving service, then they will be modifying the adversities which would inevitably come to them as a result of their cruel conduct. It is very important to remember this principle of the modification of karma. By the by, are we thinking, and am I talking contrary to the teachings of our Bible? No, there are texts, you know, to be found in the Bible which support this whole idea. I've quoted St. Paul, but even far back in Genesis 9, verse 6, we read, "Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed." And our Lord said, "For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law, till all be fulfilled." Matthew 5:18. In Luke, the words are put slightly differently. Our Lord said, "It is easier for heaven and earth to pass than one tittle of the law to fail." And he went on, "Judge not, that ye be not judged. For with what judgment ye judge, ye shall be judged. And with what measure ye meet, it shall be measured unto you again." There is suggested the exactitude of the operation of the law, isn't it? And again our Lord said, "Therefore all things, whatsoever ye would that men should do unto you, do ye even so to them, for this is the law and the prophets." That phrase, of course, has come down to us to today. And when we say this is the law and the prophets, we mean that it is the final truth. And so also prophets and great teachers who have visited mankind at different times, they have all of them enunciated the existence of this law of cause and effect. Now let me begin to sum these ideas up and suggest their application to our lives, yours and mine, how we can use this knowledge. Well, if the views which I've been putting forward are at all acceptable, and if, as I believe, they are indeed founded upon fact, then we've made a very great discovery. We've found out two of the root causes of human pain and sorrow, individual and national. What are these? Well, from my own studies of karma and theosophy in general, I have come to believe that under law there are two actions by man which he cannot perform with impunity. They always bring suffering. What are they? Well, I believe they are cruelty and enslavement, including oppression and domination, whether mental, physical, or both. Cruelty especially of man to man, man to children, to the aged and to the sick, and to criminals. Man's proverbial inhumanity to man, this produces a reaction in kind. Cruelty is a cause which gives rise to an appropriate effect. From that also we deduce a wonderful truth. If cruelty and enslavement generate suffering, then, under karmic law, kindness and the giving of freedom must bring happiness. This provides us with an unfailing guide to conduct and a way to health and happiness for each and every one of us. This way is to live in kindliness, to feel an impersonal, non-possessive affection to all and express it in action on their behalf. Someone has rather nicely expressed this ideal: always be kinder than the situation demands. Can that be remembered after this talk is over? It's rather wonderful counsel. Always be kinder than the situation demands. And of course, whilst we are kind for the sake of human kindness and not with a thought of gain, nevertheless, in every act of kindness which we perform, there is the sowing of a seed of happiness. There is a sowing from which there will be a reaping in kind. Happiness for ourselves, help for ourselves when we in our turn are needing it, perhaps becoming lame dogs who want a bit of help over a stile. It's wonderful in the world today to note how many movements there are based upon human compassion and kindness, and one does give thanks for them. As I am talking to you now, the Freedom from Hunger campaign is being worked for and contributed to by millions throughout the free world. And then there are all the other fine movements like UNRWA and UNESCO and COSO, and now relief for those poor Tibetan refugees who have fled by force their country, taken refuge in India, and are being helped by people from all over the world. It is these acts of kindness, springing up from within compassionate human hearts, it is these which, under karmic law, will eventually generate the conditions under which world peace can ultimately be established. So, history provides us with a great religious ideal that we should, that all our sufferings are the result of cruel actions, and that all our benefices are due to kindly, compassionate actions. And so we can adopt these ideals in our own lives and learn the great lesson, particularly of suffering, which is, I am my brother's keeper. We have thus an unfailing guide to conduct and a way to health and happiness, to live in kindliness and to feel impersonal affection for all. Again, I may quote the great Lord of love, who said, "Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thou thyself." By this shall all men know that ye are my disciples, if ye have love one to another. "This is my commandment," said our Lord, "that ye love one another as I have loved you. Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends." And you'll remember that even on the cross, suffering the greatest agony that it is possible perhaps for man to inflict upon man's body, our Lord said on behalf of those who were crucifying, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Not bitterness, not spite, not hate, even in the depths of agony unjustly produced. No, love, compassion, and prayer for their forgiveness. This too runs through the teachings of other great ones who have visited the world. The Lord Buddha uttered these beautiful words: "To those who revile me, I will give the protection of my most ungrudging love, and the greater their hostility, the greater shall be the measure of my love." There, friends, is greatness. The great lesson of pain, national and personal, is, "I am my brother's keeper," as I have just been saying. And I'm going to close by reading you an example of kindness and unkindness existing side by side. The story occurred in the ward of a sanatorium. And we must imagine ourselves in this ward, where the windows are too high for all of the patients to see out. But there was one man, the only one whose bed was near enough to a window to see out. Knowing the frustration of the others, this man would describe the things he saw from his lower window. The gardeners at work in spring, children going to school, young lovers strolling by, touches of life on the outside, described for those who, unfortunately, by sickness, were imprisoned within. And then a strange thing happened. One night, the patient next to this man, thinking he might be moved next to that window if the man were to die, did not call the doctor when needed. And so the man died. Eagerly, the second man asked to be moved next to the window. He raised himself for a long look at the outside world, and all he saw was a plain brick wall. The man who'd been sitting next to the window, do you see, had made it all up out of love for his fellow patients in that ward. The man who didn't feel that love and allowed him to die so that he could take his place had indeed been guilty, of a very human guilt of great unkindness. From both of these actions, there will be an absolutely appropriate effect. And so from all our actions, yours and mine, my friends, when they are consciously and deliberately performed, there will always be an exactly appropriate reaction. Allowing, let it be remembered, for the process of the modification of karma by the actions which are performed between cause and effect. So here is a great rule of life, a golden rule as it is called. Whatsoever ye would that men should do unto you, do ye unto them also. And may I close by repeating once more that beautiful sentence, that we should all try always to be kinder than the situation demands.